two massive hurricanes devastated Louisiana agriculture in 2005. While helping farmers recover from the twin disasters, Dr. Jason Rountree then realized his life's work would be developing systems to increase the resilience of food production worldwide. As an associate professor of animal science at the Michigan State University, he coordinates the Lake City and UPREC Ag Bio Research and Extension Centers, where he addresses economic, environmental, and social complexity in agriculture. He has obtained more than $2 million in funding to study how grazing livestock can improve land and mitigate climate change by capturing carbon and providing other ecosystem services. As an affiliate for the Center for Regional Food Systems, he strives to increase local food systems that strengthen local communities, which we love in Michigan. He chairs the Grass-Fed Exchange, a leading U.S. grass-fed beef educational organization, is the scientific advisor for the and an accredited holistic management educator for the Savory Institute. He's also an advisor of Standard Soil, a startup corporation that aims to meet the nation's growing demand for grass-finished beef while restoring the ecosystems they manage. So with that, Jason, I'll let you take it over.
I would have never had to do that unless the university made me. I'm a little embarrassed. So thank you all for having me. And can everybody hear me okay? I have three children, and there's never a pair of earbuds in this home that look remotely clean enough to put in your ears. And so ultimately, I decided to go without any earbuds. I don't know if any of you that have children or know what I'm talking about there. So I'm going to share my screen, and this can be very laid back. I'll briefly kind of give you guys some background on why I think the way I do, and just some of the interesting opportunities I've had to be a part of, and, you know, maybe kind of talk how that has shaped some of my thinking. I'll give you guys some insights on our research and what we're doing at the farm level, what we're learning. And then, you know, what can we do moving forward, what you can do potentially. And, you know, and the point being is I think the more that we move forward, citizen science and is going to be a huge aspect of how we accumulate and interpret data in the future. So as indicated, you know, I got my PhD at Michigan State, finished up early 2000s, had an opportunity to go to Louisiana State, and I got trained very, very classically, you know, classic types of research. I did a lot of nutrition work. All my PhDs in nutrition, master's nutrition. I've worked with cattle and hogs primarily. And so I really never thought to think out of the mold or do anything quite different. And ultimately it really changed in 2005. I was on faculty at Louisiana State, grew up on the Gulf Coast of Texas, grew up with storms. And so out of the blue, we were hit with two massive hurricanes within about 3 months of each other. And so because of that, it, was quite interesting. What I didn't realize was that people involved with extension, my main appointment was extension at LSU, were considered first responders for any type of disaster that could impair the food security of the state, which meant that without any training or insight or understanding, I was asked to go to these stricken areas and help give relief. And so actually, even before we went there, our campus at LSU was considered, you know, we basically made that into a makeshift hospital. And we actually worked right there at the basketball stadium where people were being trucked or helicoptered in from New Orleans. And so it was a very interesting experience. And so this would be just one of the kinds of scenes you would see there. This was actually after Hurricane Rita, and it is effectively about 14, 15 miles inland. So you can see the amount of storm surge that came in from Hurricane Rita, which hit, just maybe, I think it's like late October, where Katrina was around September, I believe, 5th of 2005. And so just a lot of devastation, you know, they're really rich agriculture setting, rice, crawfish, livestock, cotton, a lot of sugar cane. And so some things that I gleaned, I mean, I got to see some really crazy things. We worked south of Katrina, south of New Orleans after Katrina, just the utter devastation with 25 plus foot storm surge was crazy. And so the thing that really dawned on me, and really it was perhaps even more retrospectively, was the fact that, you know, how could we be in a land of agriculture, but yet at the same time have very little to eat? And so the point being is that everything was the base beginning for a commoditized agriculture system. And I don't think in of itself there's anything implicitly wrong with a commoditized ag system. But I think likewise, putting all your eggs in one basket is probably not the best way to go either from a standpoint of resiliency. And so at this point, I really began to search for different ways of thinking about how we produce food. I got very interested in looking at resiliency. And then and with that came local food systems. And one thing that I came across that really struck me was holistic management. And holistic management is a thought process. It's a management strategy. It can be used in everywhere, but specifically in agriculture and most of the time in land management. But it was a framework for decision-making that gets you what you want. It's effectively a way that we can embrace complexity in agriculture and try to manage economics, environment, the social aspects in the short and long term. And if you think about how we look at agriculture and our food systems, very rarely do we account for our decisions in a long-term basis. It's always a very short-term situation. Then likewise, the policies that are derived from that thinking are always putting our farmers at risk. And instead of them thinking about the best for their situations long-term, they're in just really inherently thinking about how they're going to feed their family the next year. And so I got very involved in holistic management. I, in fact, now Alan Savory is the founder of this. The Savory Institute, I work as a scientific advisor. They have the newest book of holistic management just came out this year. Really a great read, a much more simple read. And so what I was able to do then is I was able to take these background and apply it. At that time, I had an opportunity to come back to Michigan State. My PhD's from here. My advisor had retired. And so what I did then is I looked at, hey, here's an opportunity to come to a place where there is just a really neat setting. Michigan has a highly diverse ag back. You know, we're number two behind California in terms of overall diversity. I think perhaps with water issues, we may end up being number one. And Michigan State's a really cool place from a standpoint of agriculture. They allow a really good breadth of looking at food systems in a different way, which I very much appreciate. And so I came back to Michigan State and had the honor of overseeing a couple different research centers. We've got probably 15 to 20 staff across those two farms. And this is where I work. I've also included a friend, Precious Ferry, who is working in holistic management in Zimbabwe. And this was taken at a tribal farm. And so I work a lot globally as well, looking at holistic management. And this would just be their grazing plan there that has the Sazenda River and their different pastures and what they're working on. And so I just wanted to share some quick perspectives. I mean, I've been at this for about 15 years now. And the longer I do this, the less I really know, to be honest with you, or the less I'm sure of, maybe more precisely. But at the end of the day, when we think of agriculture, it's really the act of using sunlight and water to grow food and fiber on land. And then, of course, in aquaculture settings, water. But what I want to say is that we tend to make things much more complicated when it comes to agriculture. But at the end of the day, it's using natural resources. It's using things that, in many cases, are actually free to us to grow food and fiber. And I think that it's always inherent that we need to keep that foundation in mind when we look at agriculture. The other thing I've also learned is at the end of the day, there's not a technology out there. I don't care if it's certain magical fertilizers or certain genetic technologies or whatnot that can give us something for nothing. And we tend to try to look at the silver bullet, right, where there's this new technology that's going to save us. But the key is that at the end of the day, it goes back to that first bullet. We need energy, we need water, and we need healthy land to grow food and fiber to clothe us, to house us, and to feed us. And just certainly then, it's always, I think, important to point out is that as we look at this, there's only so much energy. There's only so much energy we can put into a food system. And so no matter what it is we do, there's always unintended consequences. And that's something that's really important. And the last thing that I want to point out, and it can be, I work more in modeling as it comes to life cycle assessment, which is effectively the actual entire monitoring of carbon that goes into a food system. I do more in grazing and livestock, but the point is it's basically a model that helps us monitor all the energy that goes in and out of a food system. And just a recent paper that came out this fall where came out of Brazil, but they reviewed, oh my goodness, probably 30 or 40 really key papers that were looking at soil carbon and looking at these LCAs. And they basically summarize that the greatest uncertainty, and it's a high uncertainty in these models, lies in the effect of local conditions, and it also lies in the impacts of management. And so what I want to say then is it's not a black and white issue. And I think you can say the same thing as we look at climate change models as well, as there's a tremendous amount of interpretation, a tremendous amount of basic assertions that we make that put into these models to help predict outcomes under our best, you know, under all the knowledge we have, but they're not perfect at all. And so what I've learned from that is really everything is highly complex. And so just as a point in case, is I just spent some time, last year I worked in South Africa, I worked in Kenya, I was in England here, I worked in France. So I was all over last year. And so typically, you know, we think about the positive merits of grass finishing, right? This is a really nice grass finished dairy that I was at up in north central England, up right around the Lake District, so pushing towards Scotland. And, you know, these are basically big suppliers for Nestle, think Kerrygold, think those things. And so here we've got this nice dairy, but even in this situation where they're grass finishing and we can maybe inherently think this is a great thing, in order to keep their pastures up, and the same thing in New Zealand, they're using 300 plus pounds of nitrogen per acre per year to keep those pastures going. And so what's happening then is that they're basically locked into this system that is still completely predicated on the use of fossil fuel. And so just to think about that, and this would actually be some of the manure from the cows, which is just really, really running. And the point, when you see things like that, think very high nitrogen. And so while we're grass finishing and thinking these things can be potentially good, tremendous amounts of nitrous oxide, tremendous amounts of nitrogen leaching, altering the water bodies there that are coming out of England, altering the health of the salmon and the migratory fish and other things. And so there's never really, again, you know, we can think about, well, grass finishing versus grain finishing. You know, I've been in some grain finishing models that are fantastic. And so it really comes down to those local climate, the management that's working there. And so coming back to Lake City, we had this new opportunity to change what we did. And so for about the last 30 to 40 years, Lake City had been in a very commercial, a very normal traditional cow-calf operation. We had acreages that we grazed. We did a lot of haying. We used a lot of machinery. We used a lot of fertilizer on our ground. We had cows that were really large and basically were oriented towards feedlot settings genetically. Basically, we had about 160 cows on this land, and each of those cows ate around 40 pounds a day. And our hay was costing around $80 a ton or somewhere in there to make. And so what I did, the first thing I did is I wanted to really try to look at this in a regenerative way. And can we implement strategies that are going to lower our needs for fossil fuels, for machinery? And likewise, can we also try to get rid of as much of the fertilizers and other things as we can so we can be more apt to take advantage of the free photosynthetic energy in the water and then building the soil that in turn feeds the plants that feed the cattle. And so what we did then is the first thing I did is I took 200 of our acres at our farm and I put it, that was hayed only. And just think of over time taking nutrients on and off a field and not necessarily getting all of them back. And I quit haying. I fenced everything at the farm. And what the first thing that we did is we quit the September-October hay feeding, and it extended me into December. I think I did the math one time, and it's about $15,000 to $18,000 a month I was spending on hay. So by extending the season, it saved me a great deal of money. The loader tractor, we cut 500 hours off of it in 1 year. I had a ton of labor going into haying. So basically all my labor spent all day fixing the hay equipment they broke. And we reduced our labor dramatically. We also got rid of using all of our chemical fertilizers on the place. I likewise got rid of using dewormers for the cattle. The cows now were 1,150 pounds versus 1,600. We were able to maintain, because now we're grazing our hay ground, we were able to maintain 300 total animal units, where before we were around 160. Our hay costs went up somewhat, about 100 a ton, as we brought all the hay on the farm. But it's important to note that for every ton of hay, I get $60 worth of NPK brought onto my place. And I also looked at some small-time irrigation that is a low pressure, symbolizes a rainfall that's used in New Zealand. So we basically overnight completely changed. And what we also then started doing was doing a lot of monitoring. But again, we wanted to look at energy use. We wanted to look at how our grazing systems impact carbon flux, greenhouse gas emissions. And then another thing that we really worked on was trying to develop a local supply for grass-fed beef in North Michigan. Traverse City is a fantastic area. It's one of the best places in the nation as in terms of tourism for food. And we wanted to devise some ways to get more grass-fed beef in there. I also worked at the same time to develop a local model where the grain-fed beef that was coming onto campus, we switched that into that coming from campus as well. And so effectively, this is what my model looked like from January to December. So beginning in May, we really tried to harvest as much of this green grass as you see coming in. And we used annual forages. We still do. And we'll use fertilizer on those to get our cover crops or any type of grazing annual in. We reduced our hay, and then we started marketing grass-finished cattle. We changed our genetics. We've really tried to orient towards identifying cattle that can marble and grow well on grass. And so that's basically what our model looks like in terms of our production. And so that would be a shot of our development heifers, a Red Angus base that we've got there. That would be like in July. And so the take home, and I show this to our producers, right, is as you look in 2009, I was actually getting about 74 cow days an acre. A cow day is a 30-pound grazing increment. So for every acre, I got 74 grazing days on that 1 acre through the season. I spent 142 days grazing. And then my overall pairs and yearlings that I was maintaining on that farm was about 190. In 2012, which is one of the driest years that we've had in a long time, we still were bumping up in terms of the overall amount of forage, the cattle. Now we're at 83 cow days. So I have got 9 more cow days per acre that we're getting forage utilization of. I'm grazing longer, and we're also maintaining considerably more cattle because we started grazing our hay ground. Importantly, we're still increasing the overall utilization per acre. And then finally, the last time I looked at this was at the end of 2015. The numbers have continued to grow, that we're at 110 cow days. So I went from 74 to 110. So without fertilizer, getting rid of fertilizer, we increased our overall utilization by 30%. We're grazing now 50 days longer. And then we're also maintaining a considerably higher carrying capacity at that farm. And so by lowering our inputs and essentially getting rid of certain technologies, we actually became more profitable, we're more productive, and we don't need as near as much of the inputs as the industry typically says we do. And so the other thing that we've been doing in the system then likewise is trying to say, well, what is the carbon looking like in this system? And so the work I'm going to present today is from Paige Stanley, who recently graduated from here. She's now a PhD candidate at the School of Environmental Policy at Berkeley. She's now at Berkeley and really a great, environmental food and food policy program there. And so what she did then is we took 4 years of our grass finishing, or pardon me, 5 years of our grass finishing data, all the inputs and outputs, and we also measured carbon across our farm for those 4 years, for four of those 5 years, from 2011 to 15, I believe it was. And we also then modeled, taking real data from our cattle that we also put into a feedlot. We had to do a little more modeling on that because the cattle weren't in there as long as a normal system. But what we did then is we tried to look at the overall life cycle assessment combined with what's going on with carbon, and then trying to account for the amount of carbon we may be sequestering. How does that affect the footprint? And so there's been a lot of work done. Many people would suggest that cattle are heinous to the environment because of the fact that they emit methane, from a standpoint of grazing cattle, from a standpoint of the feedlot, we've got considerable emissions coming from the cropping side. There's really key issues in terms of competing with the grain going into the cattle that could be going into a more efficient protein livestock or for direct human food. So there's a lot of things going on out there. Generally, the data would suggest that a grain-fed system is highly much more efficient and therefore better for the environment. So what we did then is we took all these emissions. Everything I'm going to show you is on a CO2 equivalent. So a CO2 equivalent per unit kilogram carcass weight. So the gray bar would represent a feedlot system. And then AMP is what we call our adaptive multi-paddock grazing, or kind of more of our holistic planned grazing approach. And so as you would imagine, because the cattle are eating considerably more forage, the cattle here are going to have a much higher emission as we apply it to per unit beef produced on enteric methane. The feedlot cattle are considerably less. Opposite would be the feed emissions on the feedlot side. They're using quite a bit of nitrogen fertilizer that's going into that system. There's more mechanization versus grazing. These cattle that we use for this would have come off an alfalfa grass system. Manure emissions were fairly comparable. On-farm energy, minimal. Mineral emissions don't even show up. So at the end of the day, though, as we look at the overall emissions of CO2 equivalents per kilogram of beef, in our model in Michigan, I think we can probably safely say upper Midwest, there's going to be about two more kilos or so of emissions per kilogram of beef. The other outcomes, I don't think I have a slide in here, is that we also looked at the land. Basically, it takes close to twice the land on a grass-fed model to grow the same amount of beef on a grain-fed model, twice the land. But what I also want to say are there are other studies that have suggested 7, 8, and 10 times the land. And I believe that speaks to broader thoughts on grazing. And what we can do with our management is really high performance, right? We're grazing, we're using our management, we're really trying to manage our forages in a proper way. And we're doing this without nitrogen fertilizer for the most part. So that's the emissions right there. The key, though, is then when I apply the soil carbon. This is kind of a messy slide, and I apologize. But what I did, because I'm not a soil scientist, I'm just a kind of a grazer type guy, is we went in and did some work in 2011 and 12 where we took a large amount of samples across our farm. 80% of our farm is a sandy loam, okay? And I went through and we went 30 centimeters deep, and we came out with this is in metric tons of carbon per hectare. And we basically came out with the fact that in 2012, that data was around 33.97. And actually, I want to say this, that's right, 12. We really started implementing those changes at the farm in about 2010, 11. So this is kind of on the front end of that. We measured in 16, and I measured all different types of soil then. Again, 85% of the farm's sandy loam, but the remaining part is the sand or clay. And what I want to show you then is that basically we saw pretty big jumps. And so when we put this work together then, I compared it now to the four-year difference of sequestration, which would be expressed as metric tons of carbon, not CO2 now, but carbon per hectare per year. And you figure a hectare is like 2.47 acres, okay? A metric ton is 1,000 kilos. And so effectively then, we looked at our sequestration, and in our sandy loam, we're comparing apples to apples, it looked like we were sequestering about 3.8 or so metric tons of carbon per hectare per year. 3.8 metric tons of carbon per hectare per year. If I took all the different rates, I get 3.59. So if I apply the sandier, lighter soil, which is right here, back to this mean beginning point, we see the 2.0. Again, ideally, I should have measured sand and clay back 4 or 5 years ago. Hindsight's 2020. So the point is that at our farm, with our management and the things that we put together, I think we're around 3.6 metric tons average, 3.8 if I compare the sandy loam to the sandy loam. And so then on the left is going to be that sequestration figure without soil. So if I looked at the fluxes, so I took my carbon, I convert it back to CO2 equivalents now. And on the left would be the green being the grass fed, the gray being the feedlot. And then I incorporated erosion in the grain system, which is pretty negligible. It doesn't impact. So again, when I look now, all of a sudden I had a system that was emitting 9.6 kilos of CO2 per kilogram of carcass that is now sequestering almost 8 kilos of CO2 per kilogram of carcass. So the numbers completely invert themselves. So now I've got a system that is actually producing protein and is a sink. So there's several caveats I want to bring up right now to this. Number one is there's an ongoing debate about dynamic equilibriums of carbon, that we can't mitigate long-term CO2 emissions with simply agriculture, because at some point we're going to reach dynamic equilibrium. So that's always a caveat out there. Number two, there's always a assumption that when we switch systems in agriculture, for instance, I went from a conventional type grazing system to one that was predicated on building soil carbon and building soil health, you're going to get greater jumps earlier. And then over time, you're going to get diminished returns as that system becomes approaching a greater amount of equilibrium. And so those are two caveats where how long will this go? I don't know. There's some comparable data from the same grazing management we apply in Texas, a drier, more arid environment. They have almost identical sequestration to ours, and they've seen that ongoing now for up to 10 years. So I think I feel confident that these numbers can continue to improve. For how long, I don't know. I also, my thoughts, again, going back to that earlier slide, is that when you look at these models that predict dynamic equilibrium, they're typically done at a big scale, and they don't look at the local dynamics as well. They don't account for management very well. And I've never seen anything in nature that is in dynamic equilibrium. I don't know of any such occurrence. And so to me, it might be somewhat of a red herring. The other important thing here too is that even if we do see diminished levels of CO of carbon uptake, we are still without question offsetting our methane. And I feel good to say that. And I think we can continue to do that as well. And so I just really want to shift here for another 5 or 10 minutes on to what's next. And so the other thing that we're working on is how do we get more adoption of what we're doing in our research center at the farm level, and how do we measure it? How do we monitor what's going on? And so I was at a soil organic carbon. It's actually from the Paris 4 over 1,000 meetings, which were the outcome of the UN meetings last year, COP21. And I was able to go and serve as a participant on some panels and other things. But one of the the people that spoke effectively says that the challenges facing ag and the institutional environment are much more complex than ever. The need to create an innovation system that encompasses that this complexity is there. It needs to involve family farmers in defining research and engaging them in a participatory way. And it needs to develop innovation and capacity in family ag through education and training. Combining farmer-led innovation and traditional knowledge with the formal research to sustainable productivity. Amen, hallelujah, whatever you want to say. That's the wheelhouse I really believe we're at. And so what we've been doing then, I've been working with the Savory Institute. We're actually launching what's called the Ecological Outcome Verification. And so this is a monitoring protocol for grazing systems. We're also beginning to work on cropping that we're working to scale up globally at all of these hubs, these blue dots that you see. I've been helping to lead this effort, working on the science behind the monitoring. And so we now actually have beginning, like if you want to call them pilot hubs, the largest in the U.S. is going to be White Oak Pastures in Georgia, which is the number one food supplier for Whole Foods, number one protein supplier for Whole Foods in the Southeast, also a big key supplier for Applegate. But we're working in Georgia, Kansas, California, of course, here in Michigan. We're working with Maple Hill Creamery in New York. But we're working at a global scale. And the point then is that can we work with these hubs to do the monitoring? It's a combination of long-term, short-term monitoring that helps for ecological health, but it also helps us measure soil carbon and other things. And then can we do that? But then likewise, can we develop a way to add value at the farm level by showing if this food is ecologically verified, meaning the food that producers, that consumers are purchasing is coming from a landscape that's improving. And so that's the key area that I really am passionate about and want to see to continue to go. I think within 5 years, if we keep it up, we're going to probably have one of the largest global monitoring protocols and amount of acreages under under monitoring in the world. And I'm doing that with the Savory Institute. So this would be, I was in South Africa, so this would just be a long-term monitoring transect on the Eastern Cape of South Africa. And what we do is we look at the spatial variation and we try to put out long-term transects where we measure 16 ecological indicators. We likewise also measure water infiltration and soil carbon. And so this is going to be an area that we're monitoring in South Africa. I also worked, and this is my friend Boston, who is actually primarily a guide for game safaris. But this is actually, I was actually working, launching this system on the Mara this year. There's a group, this is the Enunkishu Conservancy, which is on the Kenyan-Tanzania border. And they have a conservancy, but also a private company called Mara Beef, where they're buying beef from the Maasai that are grass-fed and selling it in Kenya. And so this is going to be an area there that we're also launching. And the key thing is that how do we work with communities globally that have evolved for however long on pastoral communities? And you can see these areas are highly degraded. They're short, they're overgrazed. They have high levels of game that aren't migrating like they used to because they don't hunt anymore. There's not the predator-prey relationships. And so we're working to work with the Maasai on adopting regenerative or, you know, holistic management, the grazing that we're working on. This is going to be a shot of the airplane going into that area. I had to take a puddle jumper up and down. Actually, it was four runways to get there, and I didn't throw up or anything. I was really happy. But you can see the amazing amount of degradation that's occurring. And you can see that all the livestock are in the corral here. And what needs to happen is that we need to have these livestock managed in a way where they're allowed to make animal impact, but then we've got to get them out of there and disallow the animal to overgraze. I'm seeing it work in other areas of Africa, and it's doing a tremendous amount. But this would be the advent of man-made, management-based desertification. It isn't the livestock that are doing it. It's the way we're managing the livestock that is causing the huge issues. And so this is going to be an area also in Kenya that you know, we're working here, and you can see a much healthier environment. I love this picture. I love the cattle. But generally, this is their pastoral livelihood that we have here. And so switching gears, or there's also a picture of us working our team, working with the herders that oversee that area right through there. And so finally, this is an area in Zimbabwe that I have been to and worked on as well. This is actually going to be right off the Zambezi River. They're right off of Victoria Falls, not far from Victoria Falls in Zimbabwe. This was actually 60 days after their wet season. And you can just see the dying plants that have not had animal impact, the growing amounts of bare ground. And then this is going to be about, 50 miles from there. That's my friend Biswick, who's a permaculture manager in Malawi. But this is going to be a farm that's been under holistic management for 30 years. And not to cherry pick photos, but I'm a firm believer that our work, we have to incorporate the complexity of management, understand the relationships with livestock and the land and how we can better improve those both here and globally. And so that's going to be a picture of the livestock working through that farm with the herders, really increasing stock densities, manure, urine, animal impact. But the key is those animals aren't allowed to stay there. They're moved off. Those plants are allowed to fully recover before they're regrazed. By doing that, we're building greater root systems. We're building more water holding capacity. We're building more resiliency in these communities on a global scale. So with that, I'm going to leave you with this. This is a paper I published with Richard Teague that's been the number one downloaded paper for the Journal of Soil and Water Conservation the last 2 years. And what we did is we took a paper that was published in Nature that said in order to solve the problems that we see with animals and climate change, we need to reduce the amount of ruminants by 50%. So what we did is we took that number and we looked at the impacts of livestock, farm soil erosion, as well as fertilizer and cropping. And we just did a model where if we were to just get rid of half the ruminants, we saw a slight decrease in overall emissions, which are on the y-axis. If we were to implement 25% conservation cropping using cover crops, no-till, I think in this paper, Richard used a different term, but ant grazing, that adaptive multi-paddock grazing that we're talking about, we can begin to see sinks, not only in our grazing systems, but likewise, the data suggests we can in our cropping. And if we were able to actually see 20%, 25% adoption in the United States alone, we could see almost a complete offset of the emissions we see in ag. And as we begin to build, we can see much greater ones. Now, we use the higher sequestration figure than what the models typically say. It just so happens it's the type of numbers that we're seeing at Lake City that my colleague, Dr. Teague, who I wrote this with, was seeing in Texas. But the point is that we can make big changes. We can help, I believe, mitigate the emissions that are going up through our management. And so I think with that, I'll leave you guys.
That was amazing. I do have.